We're going to look at verses 9 through 17. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 9 through 17. As always, the scriptures are going to be up here on the screen in just a moment. And you can follow along as we're reading. I'll be using the New International Version. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, beginning at verse 9. Hear now the words of the living God. For we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field, God's building. By the grace God has given me, I laid a foundation as an expert builder, and someone else is building on it. But each one should be careful how he builds. For no one can lay any foundation other than the one already laid, which is Jesus Christ. If any man builds on this foundation using gold, silver, costly stones, wood, hay, or straw, his work will be shown for what it is, because the day will bring it to light. It will be revealed with fire, and the fire will test the quality of each man's work. If what he has built survives, he will receive his reward. If it is burned up, he will suffer loss. He himself will be saved, but only as one escaping through the flames. Don't you know that you yourselves are God's temple, and that God's Spirit lives in you? If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him. For God's temple is sacred, and you are that temple. When I was a young lieutenant, I was XO of a company down in Albany, Georgia, and I had a gunnery sergeant that worked for me. He started as a staff sergeant, became a gunnery sergeant. He's a really good guy. Gunny Minio was his name, and one of the things that he was known for is how he always mixed metaphors. I don't think I ever heard him actually complete a metaphor correctly. If he was wanting to say things weren't working out the way that you thought they would, he would say, well, that's the way the cookie cracks. And then he would say, did you mean? He'd say, well, that's the way the nut crumbles. And we used to kid him and say, what kind of cooking does your wife do at home, Gunny? Because we're not sure about cookies that crack. And he never could get them correct. And it was just, we all just kind of laughed and would actually try to get him to use metaphors because he could mess them all up. And in this text, Paul's using a couple of metaphors, and he actually kind of mixes them up. Now, not quite like Gunny Minio used to do, but he's using two different metaphors, and he kind of puts them together. And we've been doing the same thing this whole year, because we're talking about building the church and planting the church. And that's really two different metaphors. And we struggled with which metaphor to use and how to work it best, because each of them have certain advantages. And that's why Paul, in fact, uses both metaphors here in this text. And I'm going to show you how he shifts very quickly from one metaphor to another, because each of them help us understand something a little distinct about our call and about what we are doing in planting the church. So we're going to dive into the text. Now, Paul begins by talking about the church as God's field and God's building, both of them. Notice in verse 9 is where he really mixes the metaphors. He said, for we're God's fellow workers, you are God's field, God's building. So there he's using two separate metaphors that you're both a field and you are a building. You are both of those things at once. And what he's trying to really point out in this passage here, one of the key elements is that God is the owner of the church. He owns it, whether you consider it a field or whether you consider it a building. Notice here when he discusses the church as God's field, he's been using an agricultural metaphor. If we'd read the whole chapter, in the couple of verses prior, Paul says this in verses 6-8. I planted the seed, Apollos watered it, but God made it grow. So neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, but only God who makes things grow. The man who plants and the man who waters have one purpose, and each will be rewarded according to his labor. So notice here he's using an agricultural metaphor. He's got seeds, he's got water, he's got things growing. He uses the word planting. So all of this is an agricultural metaphor because, of course, Paul's talking about the church growing, and it's more natural to refer to a plant growing or use an agricultural metaphor rather than saying the building grows. Interestingly enough, actually, if you look in certain passages, Paul completely mixes the metaphor and says the building grows and uses agricultural terminology of a building. But here he's kind of keeping them separate. He says, look, it's growing. There is planting and watering that is going on. And notice how he and Apollos have both labored and worked under God. In verses 6 and 7 and then verse 9, he says, I planted the seed, Apollos watered it, but God is the one who made it grow. And then in verse 7, he says, so neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, but only God who makes it grow. And in this particular metaphor, the one who planted was Paul, the one who watered was Apollos. And then down in verse 9, he even mentions, it says, we are God's fellow workers. And I'm going to come back and explain what that phrase means in a couple of moments. But notice here, he's saying that he and Apollos work in the field, but who actually owns the field? God does. In verse 9, he says, you are God's field. It's not Apollos' field. It's not Paul's field. It's not any of the other elders in Corinth's field. It is God's field. God is the one who owns the field. And so that's a good reason to use this metaphor, because very often people who owned a field weren't the ones who actually were out there doing the work in it. They hired somebody else who went out and worked in it, but those people remembered they were working in somebody else's field or someone else's vineyard. Now, Paul does the same thing actually when he considers the church as God's building. If you notice in verses 9 and 10, he again shifts to a building metaphor. You are God's field, he says, but you are also God's building. And then in verse 10, he says, by the grace of God, God has given me, I laid a foundation as an expert builder. And so here he's shifting to a building metaphor, but he's actually going to make the same points early on, which is that Paul and other people are involved in the building, but God's the one who owns the building. Notice in verses 9 and 10, he says, we're God's fellow workers, but you are God's building. And then in verse 10, by grace God's given me, I laid the foundation as an expert builder, and someone else is building on it. So there's this teamwork concept again, just like the planting and the watering. But notice in verses 16 and 17, or actually verse 9 and then 16 and 17, even though they're doing the labor, who owns the building? God is the one who owns it. In verse 9, you are God's building. In verse 16, he gets specific as to what type of building the church actually is. And he says, don't you know that you yourselves are God's temple and that God's Spirit lives in you? If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him, because God's temple is sacred and you are that temple. So notice here throughout, he's using the reference and he says, look, the building that the church is very specific. It's the temple. You're the temple of God. And who owns God's temple? God does. It's his building. And so we have the same idea going on here. Paul and Apollos plant and water. Other people can do labor in the field, but God owns the field. Paul has laid a foundation. Others are building upon it, but God is the one who owns the building. And so right up front, we have to understand, whichever metaphor we are using, the church belongs to God, not to us. It is not ours to decide what to do with the church. We are always have to be conscious of our responsibility before God. Bayridge Christian Church and Redeemer, once it is planted, are going to be held accountable by God for how we build the church, for how we plant and water. It is his church and he gets to do it. It's his building, he decides what we build. It is his building, so he decides how we build. It is his field, he decides what we're to plant, and it's his field, he decides how and where and when we harvest and all that. It is his, and it is imperative that we see that. Sometimes church leaders can speak as if it is my church. I understand sometimes it's a shorthand way of speaking, but we have to be very, very careful with that attitude. It is God's church. And leaders have the privilege and the responsibility under God of leading in the determining of what God's call for that particular body is, how to build in that particular body. But at the end of the day, make no mistake, it is God's building. And we're going to see how God is going to call to account in a few minutes on that. Now, One of the things that we run into, and this comes out in a bunch of different areas. I've had some conversations with some folks. We were talking about it at small group the other night and in some different areas. One of the things we can do sometimes is when we see that God is sovereign, some people want to say, well, then I get to sit back and do nothing. Or if we say that God owns something, then that means that I'm just inactive in the thing. The scripture never speaks that way. The scripture says the sovereignty of God actually propels us into more action and labor, not less. The scripture actually says that the fact that we realize God owns the church should free us up to say, we are building and laboring. It's God's responsibility to make it grow, but I'm going to labor with everything I have in me to see the church grow. Notice how he brings this out. In verse 9, he specifically says that Paul and Apollos are co-workers under God. In verse 9, it says, for we are God's fellow workers. That's how the New International Version translated it. Now, the King James actually has it, we are fellow workers with God. And the Greek could be understood either way. You could read the Greek phrase as we're fellow workers of God in the sense that God's working and we're working beside him in his field. God is working on the building and we're working beside him in the building. You could read the phrase that way, and that's how the King James actually translated it. But I don't think that's what's really going on here. The point is not that Paul and Apollos are co-laborers with God, it's that they are co-laborers under God together. The NIV, the newer translation in 2011, has actually rendered it this particular way. If you notice up here, for we are co-workers in God's service. And I think they're more accurate in doing that. And the reason for that, there's a couple of reasons. Number one, if you notice there in verse 9, it's we are God's fellow workers, you are God's field, God's building. All of the Greek constructions there are, it's not that we are a field along with God. We're a field beside God being a field. And we are a building beside God being a building. No, we're a field that is owned by God, and we are a building that is owned by God. And the third phrase is, we are co-laborers who are owned by God. There's no reason to read it the other way. The other reason, and it's even more important, honestly, is in the entire passage, the whole point Paul's trying to make is, don't make much of me and Apollos. We're really nothing. Because you remember the Corinthians were saying, I follow Paul, I follow Apollos. Oh, I'm a follower of Peter. And Paul's saying, Paul's nothing, Peter's nothing, Apollos is nothing, God is everything. So in the middle of that to say, but we're co-workers with God, would be to completely undermine his argument. Notice in verse 5 how he actually puts this. He says, what after all is Apollos? And what is Paul? Only servants through whom you came to believe as the Lord has assigned to each his task. Notice they're co-workers, they're each doing their part, and who ruled and told them which part to do? God. Same thing that's coming out in verse 9. So though the Greek is ambiguous and could be understood as co-laborers with God, I don't think it's Paul's point here. What he's really saying is you're co-workers and we are both working for God. We are in God's service. And this is important because what Paul wants to point out is he and Apollos labor and labor hard, but who's the one who causes growth? Only God can cause growth. Paul and Apollos can't. Notice verse 6, what he says is, after he's just said, you know, we're only servants, the Lord's assigned the task, he says, I planted the seed, Apollos watered it, but God made it grow. So notice there very quickly, but notice it's both things. Just because God's the one who causes growth, does Paul say, well, then we don't have to plant seed? Or God causes it to grow, so Apollos doesn't need to water. No. I plant, Apollos waters, we labor hard to do that, but we recognize at the end of the day, who causes seed to grow? Only God can cause the seed to grow. And this is essential for the church. Our labor can never cause the church to grow. Our labor can never accomplish God's kingdom work. We can grow organizations, and many Christian groups do that. And you can apply the proper marketing technique and you can do all kinds of things and make an organization grow. You cannot make the church grow. Your organization is growing. That does not mean the church is actually growing. That's two different things. growing the organization of Bay Ridge Christian Church and actually growing the church of God are not the same thing. And what we're really interested in is the church growing. Whether the organization grows is really inconsequential. That's not what's going to be tested on that day. What's going to be tested is, has the actual church really grown? And on that, we are dependent upon God. But again, the flip side that Paul keeps bringing out throughout does not mean that I say, well, then I just sit back and wait and we'll see what God does. No, that says I'm now free to really be able to go out and labor and work hard and trust God for what he's going to do and throw myself into it. Notice in verse 10 and 11, Paul lays out the work he's done. He says, by the grace God has given me, I laid a foundation as an expert builder, and someone else is building upon it. And he notes that that foundation is Jesus Christ. He says, no other foundation can be laid. Paul's words in verse 10, where the NIV is translated an expert builder, is literally a wise master builder. That's Paul's words. He said, look, God gave me a gift, and my gift is a wise master builder. I'm the guy who knows how to do this, and my task was to lay a foundation. The apostles are the ones who laid the foundation. And what does he say the foundation of the church is? Jesus Christ. Can the elders of Bay Ridge Christian Church get together and say, we think we got a different foundation for our church. We want to kind of stand out from the rest of the church. And so we're going to have a foundation of community service. You can do that and cease to be a church. Because the church only has one foundation. There is no other foundation. Paul says you cannot lay another foundation. Nobody can blow into Corinth now and say, yeah, well, Paul did the Jesus thing, but I've got something that's a little bit better for a foundation. Paul says, can't do that. Foundation has already been laid, and the foundation is Jesus Christ. And note, if you go back to chapter 2, that's where Paul had said, look, when I came among you, I resolved to know nothing among you except for Jesus Christ and him crucified. Now, again, that does not mean Paul didn't teach on marriage and that he didn't teach on how they were to handle living in a city full of idols and that he didn't teach on spiritual gifts and all. We know he did because this letter is full of them. But what he's saying is they're all seen through the prism of Jesus Christ. It is Christ who is God, who has become man. Christ who lived in obedience to the law. Christ who bore our sin on the cross. Christ who was crucified, dead, buried, raised, and ascended. He is the foundation. Everything goes back to him. Everything flows from him. Everything is seen through the prism of him. He is the foundation of all that we do in the church. And the church cannot have any other foundation. And so our task as leaders in the church is not to say, well, what foundation do we want to have as a church? There's only one foundation. But that, again, doesn't mean that we then have nothing to do, because we do have to decide how do we build on that foundation. And Paul says in verse 10, look, someone else is building on it, but each one should be careful how he builds. And then in verse 12, he says, if anybody builds on this foundation, let me make a point to you, because when he says, if anybody builds, there is no choice. Every person in this room is part of the church building on the foundation. A foundation is not a building. It's a foundation. Every church builds. That's not the question. The question is that Paul addresses in this text is, do you build well or do you build poorly? That's the question. You and I are building right now. Whoever's involved in going to Redeemer is building the church in this metaphor. Can't get out of not building, okay? To try and attempt to not build is to build poorly. God's ownership is no excuse for laziness on our part. You and I are going to be involved in building. The question is, what is the quality of the workmanship? Notice here he deals with the varying qualities of workmanship that are there in verses 12 and 13. He says, if any man builds on this foundation using gold, silver, costly stones, wood, hay, or straw, his work will be shown for what it is, because the day will bring it to light. And he says it's going to be revealed with fire, and the fire will test the quality of each man's work. Now, he's not listing here six different types of materials, really. There's basically two groups. There's one group that is lasting and eternal and survives a fire, gold, silver, precious jewels. There's another type that is not lasting. It's very temporal. And so when the fire comes, it doesn't survive. Originally, I had actually planned on doing this teaching back in January. So you may remember I was sick one week and had to call Gary on Saturday afternoon and said, I don't think I'm going tomorrow because I got the flu or something. And when I was doing it, there were actually some buildings collapsing up in the Northeast under the weight of some of the snow back in January, you may remember. And I was actually, my intro was originally going to be that because it was very current in what was going on. That snow tested the quality of the work. That building stood well until the snow came, okay? That's the nature of what Paul's talking about here. There is no question as to whether you're going to build and whether I'm going to build the church, because this isn't my own personal life. This is talking about the church. Not a question whether we're going to build. And there's not a question as to whether it's going to be tested. Those two things aren't the question. The only question is, what's the quality of my building and how will it survive the testing on the day of judgment? Notice on verses 13 to 15 again, the day of judgment's going to bring it to light. It'll be revealed with fire, and the fire will test the quality of each man's work. If what he has built survives, he will receive his reward. If it is burned up, he will suffer loss. He himself will be saved, but only as one escaping through the flames. Now, notice here, this statement about surviving and escaping through flames, this is not about individual salvation. This has nothing to do with purgatory or anything like that. The entire passage is about building the church. It's not about individual salvation. The whole text is plural. The whole text is building the church, and the whole text is how what we build in the church is going to survive on the day of judgment. When you stand before God and I stand before God, your salvation is going to be secure. You're not undergoing fire. God's not uncovering all your deep, dark, dirty sins for the whole universe to watch and to try and embarrass you. You are going to stand clean in the righteousness of Christ, and so am I. But the labor we have done in building his church is going to go under the fire. And it's either going to survive and be purified, or it's going to be toast. And Paul says what's going to determine that is the quality of your work now. Does it survive or does it perish? And so once again, this goes, is it possible to use the building metaphor? Can I build a really, really big house with really, really bad material? And then what happens when the test comes? Can I build a really, really small house with really, really good material? And then what happens when the test comes? It survives. This is not about fame. This is not about size. This is all about quality. How is it being built? Because Paul's saying the day is going to come. Some of you may not realize this or remember it. What was actually the biggest cause of destruction in World War II in Japan? And let me tell you, it's not Hiroshima and Nagasaki. More people actually died in the firebombing of Tokyo. And why do you think we firebombed Tokyo? What were their houses made of? Rice paper. What happens when you set rice paper on fire? The whole city was on fire. The whole place was burning down. Because when the fire came, that wood and paper construction was just made for it. So they didn't even bother trying to drop shrapnel bombs. They didn't care. You just light one on fire and the whole city went up. That's the way it did. Now, same thing can happen. If you and I have built a massive complex and we get up there and say, this thing's impressive, and God puts a little light on it and it's all wood, hay, and stubble, what's going to happen to it? It's like one of those cartoons, you know, where the whole thing burns up and you're standing there. Not what we want. But Paul says, that's what can happen. Everything else can fade. And so the question is, Will what we build together survive? And again, these texts are so often misunderstood. I'm gonna go to another problem in a second. But very often you hear this, how are you building your own personal life? That's not what this text is about. There may be other texts where we can look at that. This text is about how we build the church together. The foundation has been laid. We are each building upon that foundation of the church, not my individual life. How are we building, Paul says. And he says, you can do it well or you can do it poorly. That's the two options. Now, he then moves and he gets very specific in the building metaphor and says, look, the church is a particular building. It is the temple, which is why it's very important how we build. Notice in verses 16 and 17, he says, don't you know that you yourselves are God's temple? In other words, the church isn't just any building. It is God's building. It is the temple of God. In verse 17, he says multiple times, if anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him because God's temple is sacred and you are that temple. He is repeating himself for emphasis. He's wanting them to understand when you're building on the foundation, you're not just building a little shack somewhere, you are building the temple of God because the church is the fulfillment of the Old Testament temple. And if you go back and you look when Solomon built the temple, what kind of materials did he use? It was the most precious of stuff. I mean, it goes into all the gold and silver and precious jewels and all the ivory and all the things that were inlaid and how everything worked. The temple was made of precious stuff. And Paul says, the temple is now the church. There is no other building. Now, when Paul says this, is the temple still standing in Jerusalem? Yes. Is it the temple of God any longer? No. God does not dwell in building built by human hands. So it's of much less concern what this building looks like. There is concern for that, so we can actually get people to come here. But that's of much less concern. That's not what God is going to judge. But you and I are actually building the true temple, the spiritual house of God. And Paul says, are you building that with appropriate materials? Are you building it like it was built in the Old Testament? Or are you building it with cheap stuff? And he shows why the church is the temple in verse 16 is because the church is where God's Spirit dwells. Don't you know that you yourselves are God's temple and that God's Spirit lives in you? What made the tabernacle, what made the temple was that God's Spirit dwelt there. If you remove God's Spirit from the tabernacle, what do you have? A tent. It's just an empty tent. If you remove God's Spirit from the temple, what do you have? A really nice building. And that's all you have. You don't have anything else. The temple doesn't determine where God lives. Where God lives determines what the temple is. And where does God dwell? In the church. And so he says, you are now the temple. The church is now God's home. The church is now God's people. The church is now God's temple. And this means the reason that it's so important how we build the church is how God reveals himself in this world today. There are many in America that are belittling the church. You may listen to one individual, I won't say his name, who's promised you that the end of the world is May the 21st. I'm going to go ahead and go on record right now. It's not. I'll see you on the 22nd. Actually, I won't be here. I'll be in California. Okay? But I'll be back and I will see you because the world's not ending next week, okay? And that individual has told people, don't go to the church. The church doesn't exist anymore. Flee it. I don't need to hear anything else to say false prophet. God loves his church. I have been a Christian now for 33 years. I am not saying that out of naivete, that I don't see the problems in the church. Folks, we can make the Wicked Witch of the West look good. We got all kinds of problems, but God loves his church. There is no plan B. He's not divorcing her. He's not going somewhere else. Whatever he's going to do, he is going to do in and through the church. And don't listen to silly people who tell you find something other than the church. There is nothing other than the church. It is the church of the living God. It is his way of moving. Could he do it apart from you and me? Absolutely. He does not need you. absolutely does not need you, does not need me. If he wanted my advice, he would do much better without you and without me. But that's not how he's chosen to do it. He will work in and through the church. We are his temple. We are where his spirit lives. And we have to see, this is why in the title, we're building for the glory of God. In that phrase, I'm kind of using a little bit of a double entendre there, a dual meaning in what's going on. First, we're building, because it's God's temple, who's going to get the honor and the glory out of it being built well? God, it's his. When we were out in California last year, we went and saw the Hearst Mansion. How many of you in here have ever heard of the Hearst Mansion out in California? Some of y'all heard of that? Okay, one person built that, spent their entire life building it. Anybody know that person's name? Nor do I. Because they didn't own the house, and so you don't know who the heck they are, even though they did all the work. What you know is who owned that house. And at the end of the day, when we've done all of our labor, we are going to stand before God, and the only thing we're going to say is we were unprofitable servants, we did it, and whatever survived, may it be to glory to your name. We build for the glory of God, not our own name. I do not care if anybody knows who I am. I do not care if anybody recognizes us or anything. That is not of any concern. We are going to get to heaven, and there are going to be people that God is showering praise on. We're going to be like, who the heck is that person? I've never heard of them before. But in God's economy, he was pleased with what they did. That is what matters, not some other silly thing. So we build for God's glory because it is his building and it's for his glory. But the second way in which we build for God's glory is because his glory dwells in this building, not this building, us, the church. He dwells in us. And I dare say, if God were coming and we were building a literal building for him, we would build a nice building for him. We would build something that would make the cathedrals look trashy. Well, we are actually building something for him. We are building a place where his glory dwells. That is the church, the people, the relationships between us. And so God's glory is going to dwell there, and it has to always be kept in mind. It is God's plant, God's building, not ours. And so you and I have to give our absolute best for what we are doing. Does God accept our labor through Christ? Yes. Does that mean that I then don't give my best because, well, Christ is going to cover it anyway? No. Absolutely, positively not. It means I'm now freed up to labor extra hard to give my best. On Friday, Lynn Anderson was down here doing, getting ready for the kid stuff and walked out and then laughed because I was in here preaching at the chairs again. And she said, oh, I forgot, you're in here practicing, aren't you? Now, how long have I been preaching, folks? I preached my first sermon in 1978. I was 16, okay? Been doing this for 33 years. I realize, because through a lot of years and a lot of different ways, I know people respond to me jabbering and talking, except for my wife. She wishes I would stop. I know people do it. I still come down here every single week. I create detailed outlines and I practice. I preach at these chairs and I fuss at myself. I don't like the way that sounded. Go back and change that. Is that because Jesus isn't going to cover my lack of effort? No, he accepts what I do. It's because I'm building for God's glory and I want him to have the best. So I'm not going to give him some halfway job. I'm not going to do that. The question is not whether we build. The question is not whether what we build will be tested. The question is the quality of what I build. And that's true whether it's preaching, whether it is us working in children's ministry, whether it is the worship team, how we work with our missionaries, how we build our relationships with one another, every one of those things is gold, silver, precious jewels, wood, hay, straw. And what determines that is our labor and how hard we're doing and whether it is of great quality before God. Now, before we come to the Lord's table, I'm going to do two things for applying the word. And they're just two simple questions. Number one, do we see we're called to build the church together? Now, you may be sitting here and saying, But gee, isn't it really the church leaders who are responsible for that? And there is a sense in which Paul's words have special application to church leaders. After all, Paul was a church leader, Apollos was a church leader, and people laboring and building the church in Corinth were church leaders. And there is no question, there is a sense in which church leadership receives special application in these words. Church leaders are going to be judged for how we build on the apostolic foundation of Jesus Christ. I one day am going to stand before God and in a special sense be asked, okay, let's put the searing light of my judgment upon your labor in building Bay Ridge Christian Church as a church leader. That's true. But that doesn't mean that these words don't apply to all of us in here. Because one of the tasks of church leaders, a central task, is equipping all believers to be involved in the work of ministry and the building of the church. Notice in Ephesians chapter 4, verses 11 and 12, it's speaking of Jesus, says, it was he who gave some to be apostles and some to be prophets and some to be evangelists and some to be pastors and teachers. Why did he give these things? To prepare God's people for works of service, so that the body of Christ may be built up until we all reach unity in the faith. Notice, it is not that the leaders prepare God's people for works of service, for works of service. In other words, it's not that the leaders prepare God's people and the leaders do the works of service. Who actually does the work of ministry according to this verse? God's people, all of us. So all of us are involved in building the church. Is it possible, we have five elders, is it possible for us to do the preaching and the leading of singing and worship and leading communion and doing the ministry to the children and praying for everybody? Can we possibly do all that? No, there's no way. Is all of that part of building the church? Is all of that going to come under the fire of judgment on the last day? Is all of that gold, silver, precious jewels, or wood, hay, and straw? Every part of it is. And so all of us are called to do it. Leaders have a critical role, but every one of us are involved. There's a sense in which God is going to call the five elders up, to use today's analogy, and say, okay, let's see how she built. But then he's going to call every one of us up together. Say, how was BRCC? And I want to be standing there on that day and saying, it looks like gold, silver, and precious jewels. It doesn't have the smell of straw as the fire comes down. But we're going to determine that together. And so, are we helping build the church for God's glory? Is that what you and I are doing? And the real question in doing that is, am I using my gifts to help build God's church? How many Christians have gifts from the Holy Spirit? All. How many Christians are involved in building the church? Here's a problem we have in America. We are a consumer society and we are a spectator society. See, in the history of the world, if I used an agricultural metaphor hundreds and hundreds of years ago, who grew the food I ate? I did. I grew my own food. Do we do that today? No, most of us think that steak grows in cellophane wrapped stuff and appears down at the supermarket. It's not that way. Somebody's actually growing that food, but we're consumers. We're spectators. I had fun the other night and went to an Orioles game. We had a ball sitting there doing it. But historically, you didn't have 50,000 people sit around and watch 20 people play sports. Everybody played. Now, I enjoy getting to watch them do it, but let me tell you, worship in the building of the church is not a spectator sport. It is not that we come into, when I go to the Orioles game, I'm there and I get to judge how well they're doing, right? We've all been there and you holler at the guy in the mound, you bum, I could pitch better than that, which I really couldn't, but hey, I'll say it. See, worship is not we come in and we judge. You know, I'll give Brett a 6.5 out of 10 this morning. It's not what worship is. We are worshiping together. Building the church is not saying, I'll look and kind of see how the elders are doing this thing and throw the church council in there and we'll kind of... This is not a spectator sport. It is not a consumer event. It is us together, laboring, working, building. Am I using my gifts and being part of that? Or do I approach the church and her growth and her ministry like it's like a consumer or like a spectator? There are no spectators. Just like we've said about missions for years, radical goer, radical sender, radically disobedient. There is no spectator. There's no one sitting on the bench. Second question, how is God calling you to be involved in BRCC's vision for church planting? This year we're focusing, this is the last teaching in the series on church planting. I'm gonna be starting Jonah in a couple of weeks. We're gonna go through the book of Jonah verse by verse. We'll do some other things in the fall. Gary and I are gonna pick back up in the book of Acts. But over the summer, there's a real key question everybody here needs to be considering. Every person that is part of this church is called to be part of this church plant. Either as a goer or a sender, a supporter, some way we are involved. Some of us are gonna be called to be part of the plant. You need to be asking God this summer, am I called to be part of the new plant? Is that my call? Because sometime in September, October, we're gonna be telling people, you need to be going to Gary and letting him know you want to go. You want to be part of that plant. And some people here are called to be part of that plant, the new thing that God is doing. Is that you? And don't just quickly say no. Ask God. Seek God. Cry out to God and see if you are part of that. This church is here because some people originally helped plant this church. And this church is here because some people were here in some very difficult, not easy times. That's how churches get planted and survive. Are you called to be part of that? Or some of us are gonna help get the plant ready and do things. We're gonna say, you may help Gary do research. You may support financially. You may say, I wanna be part of really praying for this. I know I'm gonna stay, but I am going to be part of seeing this thing planted. I'm not just sitting on the side as a spectator and wondering how it works out at the end. I am seriously gonna give myself to do that. Some people are gonna need to fill roles here. We're gonna have some people leave and they were doing things in this church. Somebody's gotta step up and begin doing those things then and really working and laboring to do that. And so the question is, how is God calling you to be part of the vision? Every one of you in here need to be able to answer that question. This is my part, my role. Everybody has a task in that. Now, we're gonna conclude by coming to the Lord's table. And that may seem a little unusual when I've just gone through this, but I again wanna remind you, everything we're doing is about Jesus Christ and what he's done for us. And the mistake always when you're doing things, I realize here we're talking about building and planting and laboring, and that can sound like, you know, a call to action. We don't live by law, we live by gospel. We don't live by our own strength and energy. Who provides energy so that we can even plant and sow? Only God can do that. Paul could have developed the analogy further. It was God gave him the strength to even do the planting in the first place. Who provided the seed? Who provided the water? I mean, I can go back and show you that God says, I'm the one who provides seed for the sower and bread for the eater. I'm the one that provides all of that. Our strength does not come from us buckling down and us doing it on our own. Our strength comes from broken body and shed blood. Our strength does not come from our own energy, but what Christ has done for us. And so I want to urge you this morning to look to God for strength. Every time we are called and we are off doing things, you should always recognize what you're doing requires more than what you can bring to bear. In the church, you and I can't make it happen. And God is going to call you and call me to things that are going to be beyond our abilities. The very first time I preached, I'd been a Christian for 3 months. That was it. All everybody knew was I'd gotten saved on a Sunday afternoon and nobody could shut me up talking about Jesus for the next 3 months. And some people thought that some of the drugs I'd been doing had kind of gone to my head or something. 3 months in, do you think I was a little nervous when I stood up? Was that beyond my capabilities? Way beyond them. God was gracious and met me that morning and anointed me and used me in whatever small fashion he could do there in that little Baptist church in Georgia, because it's his strength that does that. And it doesn't matter now, 33 years later, if God's going to bless my teaching on a Sunday, it's going to be him that's going to do it. It doesn't matter. All my preparation cannot cause God's word to sink home to your heart. Whatever your gift, call, and task is, it's broken body and shed blood that will make it effective. And so, I am at your service, and I ask you to